You're having a party, and you set up enough chairs and seating for everyone. As the night rolls on, where does everyone end up? In the kitchen. It's In the Kitchen on the next Mind's Eye Radio. You'll hear how composer Samuel Barber loved soup and wanted to be buried with a sprinkling of croutons over his coffin. How memories of simmering soups and clattering pots can trigger a lifetime of love, loss, gatherings, and grief. It's In the Kitchen on the next Mind's Eye Radio. That's Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. Say the word kitchen, and you're likely to evoke some pretty vivid images in the minds of your listeners. For most of us, kitchens recall golden moments of togetherness with family and friends, places of exotic sights, sounds, and especially aromas. In his wonderful book, Dandelion Wine, Ray Bradbury writes about the kitchen of Douglas Spaulding. "Grandma," he had often wanted to say, "is this where the world began? For surely it had begun in no other than a place like this. The kitchen without a doubt was the center of all creation. All things revolved about it. It was the pediment that sustained the temple." You've tuned in to In the Kitchen on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Greg Willard. In the next hour, the Mind's Eye writers will treat us to a smorgasbord of stories, poems, and essays based upon their experiences in the kitchen. We'll visit the kitchen of composer Samuel Barber, whose cook became a collaborator. We'll discover the difficulties involved in undertaking a change in the family diet. And we'll reminisce about kitchens out of childhood, rooms where all life converged. That and much more. So join us in a look at the many roles the kitchen plays in our lives. The table's set, and we're about to revisit Ray Bradbury's Center of All Creation. While the kitchen is traditionally the place for culinary art, it can also serve as the inspiration for the fine arts as well. That's especially true when circumstances require an individual to tend to her domestic responsibilities while pursuing her creative dreams, as we'll see in writer Sharon Van Sluis's essay, The Kitchen Muse.
The kitchen of my childhood was the usual farm kitchen of a large family, expansive, bustling, the heart of the house. There was the usual procession of meals for the eventual seven of us, of course, but also the intensive canning and freezing, the putting by, of the fruits of our acre garden from late summer through the fall. Strawberries, beans, peas, cucumbers, raspberries, beets, corn, and finally, apples from my grandparents' orchard. The kitchen table was also the spot for the sewing machine, the place for my father to read the paper, the stage for Play-Doh and other messy toys, the laboratory for new recipes, the place for my mother to set her hair, mirror, bobby pins, and bristly rollers in a plastic tub in front of her, on Saturday nights to look nice for church the next morning. The kitchen was the fount of my mother's domestic life, but also it was her muse. Before she married at 22, my mother wanted to be an artist. After high school, she managed to take a technical drawing course and worked for a short time as an architectural draftsperson. After she married and had several children, she followed perhaps what was the only route resembling fine art available to her. She enrolled in the 2-year Famous Artists Correspondence course. "Can you draw this?" the magazine ads would ask, above the simple drawing of a Labrador in profile, or a cat, or a squirrel. Today it would sound bogus. How can you become an artist through the mail? But it was legitimate. And for those like my mother, with tremendous native talent and determination, it was the way to proceed. My mother had talent, a tenacious will, no means to attend art school, and 3 young children at home. Famous artists became her studio class, and it was exactly what she needed, the promise always kept that someone would receive her mailed lessons, comment extensively and intelligently, make many suggestions, mail it back to her, and expect her to improve and respond in a timely fashion. She set up her still life lesson tableau on the big round kitchen table after the kids were finally exhausted and shooed to bed. I was the oldest and sometimes watched her set up. Red crab apples in a shiny stainless steel bowl, the various ingredients and tools of canning them assembled around the lovely fruit, a bottle of cider vinegar, a bag of sugar, cinnamon sticks, wooden spoon, paring knife, cutting board. She would arrange the pieces again and again against a bit of drapery backdrop until it was balanced, pleasing, just right, and then paint and paint late until my father would urge her to bed. In the morning, the pieces would be neatly stacked on the counter, the table cleared and ready for the day's parade. Later, when she had advanced to portraits, she would take Polaroid photos of us for her studies and then paint at the table from the photos. There's the oil portrait of Cassie at age 3, looking over the back of the gray vinyl kitchen chair, her eyes just the right light green, her hair just the right red blonde. There's my great-grandmother peeling apples in a fresh calico apron, her snowy white hair a cloud around her head, the pile of Northern Spy apples on the table in front of her, deep red and slightly striped with green in places, just as you would see them, just as they are. There's the portrait of my great-uncle Jake seated, bent and gnome-like, in a kitchen chair, about to place his dark violin under his chin, his watery blue eyes looking up briefly over his half-glasses. The kitchen was my mother's domestic fount, and prison, I came to see, since the work just never stopped, as well as her muse. My mother continued painting beyond her graduation until a short time after the fifth child was born. My mother bore 5 children in 6 years, and there was finally a limit to her energy. She began painting in earnest again after we all left home, many years later, but for a time she nearly stopped. This poem is the image of my mother at the time she knew she must put aside her easel and paints for a while. She is not painting today. My mother is sitting in a small pocket of the afternoon on a beige couch. Her hands are still, her fingertips, soft and precise as sable brushes, are folded toward the inside of her palms. My mother's gray eyes move to the window pane, following the green shades of trees. The leaves blow like sheaves of paper, the shifting undersides turn up dull silver. She is memorizing the sky, the lines of calm blue between the flashing hues. She remembers the spaces between. She rises and pulls the shade. Her right hand rocks the worn wicker cradle where the new child sleeps. She brushes the fine russet hair with those fingertips and follows the curve of the cheek, pure ivory and smooth as new paint. This is Sharon Van Sluis, Somewhere in the Kitchen for Mind's Eye Radio.
In my kitchen, you'll find comic strips.
Madison writer Kathy Miner.
Oh, sure. You'll also find the usual dishes, utensils, pots and pans, spices and foodstuffs. But over there, next to the doorway, it's not a refrigerator at all, my mother once said. It's a kiosk for newspaper cartoons. I'm an inveterate collector, and since we get both the morning and the afternoon newspaper, I have copious material to work with. I once had an email conversation with a professional cartoonist about the parallels between his work and mine. I've been a poet for more than 40 years, I said, and if I don't read anything else in the newspaper, I always read the funnies. Maybe there's a reason for that. Maybe cartoons and poetry are more alike than we think. They both go to some core emotional truth, some kernel, and they both do it sparely, with a minimum of lines. All unnecessary detail and background have been trimmed away, so you go right to the important stuff. And furthermore, I said, both use a specific instance or depiction in the hope of making contact with others, which is the whole point, the contact and the hope. Whereupon this man, whom I've never met but whose work is syndicated in hundreds of newspapers, said, "It's perfect. I love it. Cartoons as visual poetry. Couldn't somebody, like, write a dissertation about that?" So the front of my Frigidaire is covered with poetry, I mean comic strips, anchored by a motley crew of magnets. In principle, it's a rotating collection, with old clippings displaced as new ones are added, but a few are more or less permanent residents, and the state of my addiction is such that several years ago, I actually bought a scrapbook in which to save the ones that I couldn't bear to throw away when their terms expired. The Kitchen Collection, it's called. At this point, flipping through the book is like paging through our family's life. There's an old funky winker bean. Two oak leaves are hanging from a branch. One says to the other, "How's your midleaf crisis going?" Responds the second, "I'm coping." Greg Howard's Sally Forth is well represented. Here's a scene between Sally and her daughter Hillary. Sally has a guilty look on her face and one hand behind her back. "Aha! Are you eating a chocolate chip cookie for breakfast?"
"I'm rushed."
"How many times have you told me, 'Eat a good breakfast, Hillary. It's the most important meal of the day.' And now I find my principal role model eating a cookie for breakfast. Arg!"
"I'm lucky she didn't see the root beer."
Two different attitudes toward children starting school are illustrated first by a single-panel Jerry Marcus cartoon showing a mom in curlers and bathrobe sitting on the front step, a magnum of champagne chilling next to her, and a glass in her hand. The mailman is coming up the block. Noticing the woman's blissful smile and the bubbles all around her head, he asks, "Kids go back to school today?" But the flip side of that page shows another aspect of September, this one from the family circus. It's little Billy's very first day of school, ever, and as his mother waves to him from the car, she hears his childish voice asking questions from the past. "Can you take a nap with me, Mommy? Mommy, how do you write 11-teen? "Don't worry, I'll stay right here in the backyard." "I can't tie my shoe, Mommy. I hurt my knee. Will you kiss it?" "I'm afraid of the dark." Over her head arches the thought, "Treat him gently, world, and teach him well." The best humor, I think, probes some deep understanding about ourselves and includes just a touch of ruefulness or outright anger. Here's a Beetle Bailey strip that I've saved for 20 years.
"Halt and identify yourself."
"Lieutenant Sonny Fuzz, 01335506 A Company, 374th Battalion. Blonde hair, blue eyes, 5'8", 146 pounds, age 22, born in Crop Dip, Arkansas. Hobbies, stamp collecting."
Okay, you can pass. Why do some people always tell you more than you want to know?"
That one not only made the refrigerator, but spent close to a decade taped to my dresser mirror besides. It didn't help. I still have a tendency to run on at the mouth. We can ignore doing the house cleaning, but we can't ignore thinking and laughing about it. Two different strips now consigned to the scrapbook deal with the pleasures of laundry. And then there's this from the family circus. The children are answering the door, where a lady with a purse stands on the doorstep. "Mommy's cleaning the bathroom," the little girl offers. "Are you the company we're expecting?" And this one from Wildlife.
"Hanley, who on earth put the terrarium in the blankety-blank refrigerator?"
"Terrarium?
Terrarium?
Terrarium? Oh, you were looking at the cottage cheese."
"You know, we've got to clean this thing out more often."
That one really hit home. I've been infamous over the years for forgetting leftovers on the back shelves of the refrigerator. "Looks like Mom's doing science experiments again," the boys would observe. Like everyone else, my husband and I have gotten older and grayer, and like most everyone else, we're trying to take it with grace and humor. But as Dennis the Menace says to his little friend, "You know, Joey, as your mom and dad get older, they act more and more like the parents on those black and white TV shows." We remember the summer of Woodstock, and we laughed and winced over Jim Borgman's 1994 panel depicting the 25th anniversary concert. A balding, pot-bellied man in a peace T-shirt stands on the soundstage announcing, "People, we have a report of some bad antacid going around." I think it was my mother-in-law who sent us the Six Chicks strip, showing a woman taking modern maturity out of the mailbox and saying to her husband, "It's official. We are stardust. We are golden agers." And then there's Real Life Adventures, this one captioned, "Computers aren't the only thing with random access memory." Honey, do you remember Ed and Donna's phone number?
No, but I remember your social security number and the Munsters' address.
Oh, good. That helps. I said before that I'm a poet. I've written at least two poems based on the content of comic strips. One of them was about this strip, Name of Priscilla's Pop, which appeared daily in the Milwaukee Journal during my growing up years. If I'm reading the date correctly, this particular one was published on June 20th, 1977. Priscilla, a little girl, is out on the sidewalk riding her hobby horse when their pastor comes by.
Do you ever make mistakes, Reverend Weems?
Heavens yes, child. Everyone makes mistakes. This is the way we grow as human beings.
In the last panel, Priscilla is approaching her father in his armchair.
Here's my final report card, Pop. I'm going to be a great human being.
I could go on. There are 52 pages in the scrapbook, and with 2 to 4 comics per page, well, you do the math. Not to mention the newest of the new, the even dozen currently enjoying their run on the, kiosk. But I'll close with the very first one in the kitchen collection book. It's from High and Lois, and my mother sent it years ago. Will you put this in the refrigerator for me?
Sure. Where is it?
It's over there, behind the comic strips. With deep gratitude to Tom Baddock, Jim Borgman, Dick Brown, Greg Howard, Bill Keen, Hank Ketchum, John Kovalik, Jerry Marcus, Margaret Schulock, Al Vermeer, Mort, Brian, and Greg Walker, Gary Wise, and Lance Aldrich, and many, many others for all the laughs over the years in all the rooms of the house. This is Kathy Miner for Mind's Eye Radio.
One of my favorites of all time is this Rose's Rose. Oh, God, I love her when she morphs into Vicky the Biker Chick. I just love it.
One day, while rinsing out her mug and spoon in the kitchen sink, writer Fran Rawl remembered seeing her aunt, years ago, going to the pantry to get a dipper of water for a last drink at night. That experience instilled Rawl with a lifelong awareness of the need to conserve water against the possibility that it would someday become scarce. She recalls the early incident and its consequences in her poem Cold Water Thoughts.
They used to sit on a bench outside the farmhouse kitchen door, a pail of water, a basin, and a dipper. People took a drink, washed hands or feet, rinsed dirt off a carrot fresh from the garden. My aunt and my father-in-law both kept a dipper for a private drink, flicking the droplets away and rehanging it on its nail. I wash out my cup and my spoon right after I drink my coffee. Rinsing a few coffee stains dribble down the side, the spoon still a bit sticky from the honey, with cold water. It takes almost a wasted gallon to run hot. My husband, partner, friend never uses them. His special cup sits on the stove away from my snatching hand. They are juxtaposed only during communal dishwashing. How many thoughts do I have washed in cold water? Private, subliminal, not consequential in some ways, but mine alone, not to be intruded upon. The nasty, the wild, the really sweet babies, layered in with the grocery lists, projects uncompleted, the last time I dusted. Floating around, rebounding from harsh realities, hiding in various cracks, bubbling up, unspoken, but not unfelt. Mine alone, untapped, except by me, sorted out as to fantasy, shame, profound, not of consequence. It's busy in there, undisturbed by cold water washing. This is Fran Rawl for Mind's Eye Radio.
Thank you.
The kitchen is the room in most houses where children are introduced to adult society, if not at the table, then surely in overheard conversations among parents and other grown-ups. In rare cases, a child's future career may even be influenced by his kitchen companions, as it was for American composer Samuel Barber. Writer Paul Thompson explains.
We don't know who was in the kitchen with Dinah, but we do know who was in the kitchen with Annie Noble, the family cook when young would-be composer Samuel Barber was growing up. Samuel's family was old Irish, while Annie had been brought over from Ireland by his grandmother, and she sang the songs of the old country. Samuel loved to hear the plaintive Irish airs. I imagine him seated at the kitchen table while she sang as she fixed the hearty dishes of the day, corned beef and cabbage, chowders, roast chicken and duck, mashed potatoes, apple and cherry pie, peaked curds of whipped cream. Perhaps when Annie mixed cake batter, she let him scrape out the bowl. Beyond listening to Annie, young Samuel Barber loved music in general and began playing the piano when he was 6 and composing a year later. His interest in and knowledge of music were reinforced by spending the summers with his mother's sister, Louise Homer, a Metropolitan Opera singer, and her husband, a well-known composer of songs. However, his doctor father and his mother preferred him to focus on athletics and further down the line, perhaps a medical career. When Samuel was 9, he left a note on his mother's dressing table. To begin with, I was not meant to be an athlete. I was meant to be a composer, and will be, I'm sure. Don't ask me to go and play football. Cook Annie was a reader, something of a poet, and had what has been called a darkly humorous imagination. When Samuel was 10, he and Annie worked together to create the first act of an opera, The Rose Tree, Annie writing the libretto and Samuel the music. The work, the manuscript of which survives, concerned a tenor of the Metropolitan Opera Company who vacations in a small 19th century Florida town and falls in love with a local girl. Unfortunately, Annie apparently left the household at this time, and the opera was never completed, although Barber in later life looked for someone who might finish the libretto. Barber never forgot the words of the opening gypsy chorus, according to biographer Barbara Heyman, and in later years would occasionally amuse his friends at parties by singing bits of the song. A wandering gypsy we, the whole wide world is ours. We glance and sing with gladsome glee through the summer hours. We care not for the toilsome way the world so madly follows. Our hearts are light, our lives are gay and free from care as swallows. Annie may have influenced him in another way. As an adult, he loved good cooking, especially soups. I would like, he once said, to be buried with a sprinkling of croutons over my coffin. At age 14, Barber began attending classes at the newly formed Curtis Institute of Music in nearby Philadelphia, where he was outstanding in piano, voice, and composition. He went on to write songs, operas, symphonies, quartets, and works for piano, never forsaking his Irish roots in melody. His early work included A Slumber Song of the Madonna, based on a text by the English poet Alfred Noyes. Although influenced by developments in atonal and 12-tone music, Barber stuck with harmony and traditional forms. He was an immensely popular composer during much of his career, one of the few able to make a living purely from his music. But he never found composition easy. As his fellow composer John Carlo Minotti stated, "He was so gifted, but actually he was a very tormented soul. He was never happy with what he had done. He was only happy when he was composing. When he finished the piece, he could not bear to look at it. And he also suffered a great deal because he went through long periods of dryness. But once he'd gotten into a piece, he would work day and night without stopping. For the general public, Barber's best-known work is the Adagio for Strings, a movement from a larger string quartet written in 1936. Adagio has been featured in several movie scores, including Platoon and Elephant Man. Listeners to National Public Radio voted it one of the 100 top musical compositions of the 20th century, and in the wake of September 11th, it was one of the pieces most often requested by classical radio listeners. Barber's career flourished through the early 1960s. His Concerto for Piano and Orchestra, written for the opening of the Philharmonic Hall at the Kennedy Center, won critical acclaim. That was followed, however, by a fiercely criticized opera based on Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. That was his last major work. During the remaining 15 years of his life, he suffered from depression, alcoholism, and prolonged creative blocks. In those hard, late years, before his death of cancer in 1981, did Samuel Barber recall a better time, when he was young, and sat in the kitchen listening to Annie sing as she peeled potatoes or stirred the simmering pots on the Black Iron Range? Despite the shadows that closed in on him, the youthful lyrical spirit that responded so ardently to Annie's song endures in his work, and today his romantic lyricism is influencing a new generation of composers. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
You're listening to In the Kitchen on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up, we'll take a look at a heartwarming memoir of the influence of the kitchen on the life of a boy, and then a man, and find out what happens when a mother decides it's time for her family to try a vegetarian diet. I'm Greg Willard. Stay with us.
Julia Child turns 90 this year. 90! Julia. Today we will do a little something with juniper berries.
Writer Norma Gay Pruitt.
I was grazing the recipes of this week's New York Times Magazine, which explained how someone named Debbie, evidently famous, had done things with vegetables that would make a confirmed carnivore ashamed of his habit. Hey, you want to go vegetarian this summer? I yelled to my husband, who was doing the taxes and in no mood for trivial gastronomic planning. As usual, Ken didn't grace my silly inquiry with a response, so I kept on marketing the idea. I suggested that since we are already members of a farming cooperative, it would be best to start in the summer when veggies were plentiful. We already get this heaping box of cool things we've never seen before, and sometimes those Martian-y green tentacled kinds sort of sit in the fridge until they shrink to nothingness. And that was really a waste of money, and he sat up straight at that word, but still didn't respond. As usual, I didn't really care whether he responded because I was already well into thinking how good that first meatless summer would sound as a chapter in my memoirs, which I am hard at work writing, having decided to skip the distasteful step of getting famous first so that anybody would want to read my memoirs. Then I decided to check out the ingredients in one of the recipes. Near the top of the list was the item juniper berries, stated as matter-of-factly as one might write salt, which in these recipes is never salt, but rather kosher, dill, cranapple, diced salt. Juniper berries, I snorted. Ken said, huh? And I waited for a follow-up, which never came. It's difficult to pique the interest of a man who's up to his armpits and non-deductibles. Also, my last pre-tax conversational bid concerned trying to find out from him whether he's ever heard of people piercing their pets' ears. And my head, as everybody knows, is a great gumball machine. Whatever thought tumbles down out of my cranium is immediately shot out of my mouth. Since it was clear Ken wasn't sharing my interest in these random musings, I began to imagine myself hopping off to the corner grocery for a packet of juniper berries. How the clerks at Norris Court would look at me when I requested help finding them on the shelf. Now, I like Norris Court, but sometimes I can't find even fairly normal stuff there, like yeast and cottage cheese and marshmallow cream. So I doubt they stock juniper berries on any kind of regular basis. But forgive me for being just a little disingenuous, since Madison, Wisconsin is pretty cosmopolitan when it comes to food. If Norris Court doesn't have juniper berries, there's still one of the many cooperatives which stock things like royal bee jelly and pollen, which apparently somebody finds palatable. Or maybe it's just for greasing squeaky bees. Then I began to wonder how the juniper berry scene would play out in a really small town, say Plum Thicket, Illinois, population 200, mostly dead, where I was raised. I could just see myself, now grown up and having been forced by the witnessed relocation program to return to live in Plum Thicket for my own protection, which is the only way I would ever return to live in Plum Thicket. Though even the grocery store dried up there years ago, in my youth we had Hegg's Grocery, which stocked the usual stuff. Lots of corned beef hash and Campbell's soup, and a few fresh things, though the fruit and vegetable bin was pretty much restricted to items nobody could or did grow in their gardens, a few oranges and some celery. The dusty ceiling fans turned in the pressed tin ceiling year-round, and the floors were wooden planks. The meat freezer always smelled a little off, but the milk was 100% butterfat and the bread was Sunbeam. We bought salty seal test ice cream in small cardboardy tasting cups and ate it with wooden spatula spoons, which could leave slivers, they were so crude, though it was worth the risk. Seal test came in your choice of flavors as long as it was vanilla. Mr. and Mrs. Hegg, knowing their clientele, specialized in penny candy, especially the suckers called Safe Tea Pops, the letters embossed on the surface and the handle a white string looped through the bottom. There were pastel wafers and pellucid waxed rolls and bit of honey candy bars and bazooka pink bubble gum. At Christmas, they brought in a few turkeys and hams, though I don't remember my family ever getting either. But juniper berries? It wouldn't surprise me if when the adult me even asked that question, the news of my request would ricochet through the seven streets of that town like news of an outbreak of anthrax, so that by evening of the same day, the preacher of the First Methodist Church would be trying to figure out how to quell the disturbance. Public consternation would be even greater than the time a full-racked bull moose was found wandering around by the grain elevator one cold Sunday morning. The story might be bigger than the one about the talking mina bird that flew through Mrs. Cantrell's kitchen window, shat on her doily, and came to rest on the Philco. Maybe we'll not go vegetarian, a la the New York Times Magazine. Maybe it's safer to start with a few bean sprouts and tofu and work our way up. I heard that one couple is eating whole wheat bread in Plum Thicket. The rest of the town is waiting to see what will happen to them. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, who prefers her juniper berries well soused in gin, for Mind's Eye Radio.
A kitchen is much more than a place. For many, it's the repository of lifelong tales of triumph and defeat, joy and anguish, smiles and tears. Looking back, we see our personal successes and failures in the looking glass we call the kitchen. Gaither Voltzen shares his life in the kitchen in this prose poem.
In the kitchen, I slowly wake up in the patient stillness of morning, hum bits of a song left over from a dream or last night's radio. I place both hands on the counter and bow, back straight, head down, groan as blood finds its way to my extremities. In the kitchen, again the morning, with just my mom. I am 6, barefoot, an early riser like her. My head reaches just above the counter where percolator coffee sputters, infuses the air with earthy smells. Mom makes box lunches at the chopping block counter. She is dressed in her pink housecoat. In front of her lays a checkerboard of custom-made sandwiches for the family. Bologna, P&J, ham and cheese, tuna fish. She is so beautiful and I am so in love with her that I dare not speak or move. Just watch. In the kitchen, at dinner, I sit next to my father, always. Within a slap's reach, he jokes, to keep me in line. My eyes furtively trace the dark blue rivers of veins in his arm. I pause at the spot in the crook of his elbow where the vein rises and falls, a pulsing living thing. I am proud and frightened. It seems the 5 other children sit next to Mom. In the kitchen, I am cornered by a shouting, red-faced mom, her wooden spoon raised high. Her other hand grips my shoulder and spins me. The spoon finds my behind like a heat-seeking missile, and all is loud and threatening and crashing. I will not cry, but will laugh like a crazy boy. Again the spoon until it breaks. In the kitchen, my 1-year-old sister in the sink, a bubble bath. The phone rings, Mom turns, and my sister stands up, takes a dive onto the floor, head first. Don't let her go to sleep, Mom yells to me as she heads next door to the Gettys for help. I hold my wet sister's head in my lap and talk baby talk. Sunday in the kitchen. Dad always cooks brunch. Coffee, juice, eggs, bacon, toast, hash browns. Then sends us off to church and goes fishing. His deal with God. In the kitchen. My older sister washes dishes. My brother and I dry, racing, chipping the plates, rattling the silver, our ears tuned like transistor radios to the calls of other children, already on the street playing ball or chasing fireflies, and us left wondering why it is they don't have to do the dishes. In the kitchen, my father bleeds, severed finger gripped tight in his still good hand, as if milking the injured one for all the red juice it can give. His furrowed face is coarse with whiskers, like when we go fishing really early, and there is no time for shaving. In the kitchen there is Norwegian meatballs, lapskaus, jetost, fiskebolla, lefse, anchois, julekaka, krumakaka, and on Sunday night, chop suey and sticky rice in white cardboard boxes containing fortunes from another place. In the kitchen, I relax in the tub, stoned, reading Goethe's Young Werther. It is my first apartment, a regular writer's garret. I can hear small splashings. My dog, Willie, drinking from the toilet in the closet. In the kitchen, I slide in behind my wife, ease into her back as my hands follow the ridge bone of her hip. She says, and her hands hesitate, lost in the cumulus clouds of soapy water. My hands encircle her waist, then gently lift, like cups asking for more. Her back arches, her bottom pressing soft cushion to my middle. I sniff and nibble her neck, like an ear of sweet, sweet corn. In the kitchen, my friends, neighbors of the round table, Gary, Paul, Barbara, Jeff, a rollicking chaos of Schmidt's beer, chips, cards, and rambling conversation. And yes, the dog asleep by the stove, and winter held securely outside, and all is warm and good and forever. In the kitchen, you and I again, our backs pressing against opposite counters, maximizing space between us, proving that opposites do not attract. Our arms wrap like shields across our chests, the words gone for the moment, and all that is us is dripping water, ticking clocks, and the humming, vibrating refrigerator, as if it doesn't know whether to explode or stop altogether. Our faces are dry now, our mouths grim and set like wood. In the kitchen, it is hard to find me. But if you listen, you can follow the gasping sounds of weeping. I'm in the corner, on the floor, behind the table, a full-grown man squatting, crying, his eyes desperately tracing patterned swirls of linoleum that lead not far enough away from this place. And even if they did, he cannot move for fear his heart will not stand the strain. In the kitchen, a small table, my daughter and I. Don't forget your broccoli, I say. She opens her mouth wide and smiles because it is full of green. I chuckle, lean back in my chair and sigh, resting for the moment, adoring her as she lives her own life in the kitchen. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
The kitchen is a focus for family activity every day of the year, but at holidays, it can be the very heart and soul of the house. That's especially true when circumstances require two sisters to come to grips with their past and an uncertain future. That's the theme of Evie Thompson's story, Easter Eggs.
We've been dyeing Easter eggs, my sister Ellen and I, and we're taking a break. Standing on the kitchen stool, she reached into the topmost recesses of her kitchen cabinets, then stepped down, holding a silver water pitcher. As she handed the pitcher to me, the reflection of her face and white turban, distorted by the curve of the bowl, stretched from side to side. Ellen's hair had fallen out, so she wore the turban every day now. She said, "I want you to have my silver service." I felt my face becoming solid. We were raised not to cry in our family. Instead, my throat felt like it was closing up. "Your service is very beautiful, but, you know, I've never liked cleaning silver, and we rarely entertain." "If you had good silver, you might entertain more often. And I have these wonderful mitts that you rub over the silver, and it cleans right up." She polished the corner of the pitcher with the elbow of her jumpsuit, like a sales lady showing off the product to best advantage. We sat down at the table. Dead eggshells, their potential for life blown out of them, sat in the egg carton by my elbow. Her husband Roy had prepared a dozen eggs for us, and we had completed five or six. Ellen picked up an unfinished egg and dropped it into the purple dye. "I was thinking about it the other day," she said. "Dad played with you a lot." "Yeah, he used to take hold of my hands and let me walk up his legs and somersault over." He never played with me like that. Really? No wonder you pushed me in the pool that time. I nearly drowned. Oh, Katie, that was an accident. I'd been looking over my shoulder, and when I turned around, you were just there, right under my elbow. It was an accident. I hope you believe me. Sure, I said, not really sure, but wanting her to be comforted. I just realized that I was Dad's favorite. I picked up another egg. I'm not big on crafts, but Ellen seemed to want to do it, and it gave us something to do. I took a crayon and drew some geometric shapes around the middle. Then I drew flowers on each end. That reminded me of when we were young. Ellen and I used to go into the woods each spring to pick wildflowers. We'd take our shoes off and wade in the icy creek. Suddenly, the light in the kitchen seemed too bright. That big fluorescent in the ceiling and those carefully polished chrome and porcelain surfaces hurt my eyes. I felt as if I was getting a sore throat. Looking down at my egg and struggling for something to talk about, I said, "It's really nice of Roy to blow all these eggs for us." "Are you going to speak up, or are you just going to sit there and mumble?" she snapped. "I said, it's nice of Roy to blow eggs for us." I glared at her. She was the big sister again, and I was 6 years old to her 11. I held my egg under in the dye until my anger dissipated. Gradually, the blue on the egg came to match the color in the wall tile Ellen had picked up in Mexico. That had been quite a trip, Mexico. The hang gliding there had been even more of a thrill for her than the wild river rafting she'd done the year before. "We're thinking of going on a vacation to Florida," I said. "We want to go snorkeling along the reefs, but I'm worried because I'm so nearsighted I won't be able to see underwater." Ellen glanced up over her egg. "You'll probably run into some sharks." Roy came into the kitchen then. "Looks like you girls have pretty well dyed most of those eggs." He started getting another carton of eggs out of the refrigerator. "Oh, no, Roy, don't do more on my account," I said. But Roy went over to the sink and started blowing eggs anyway. On the counter to Roy's left sat the silver pitcher, its metal gleaming coldly. I knew that in the years ahead I would be cleaning it long after Ellen's mitts had worn out. We fell silent. I thought, we're not saying anything important, and time is so short. But there really wasn't anything I could say, so I just worked on the eggs. This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
This is In the Kitchen on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up in the next part of our show, we'll take a look at some of the more disagreeable kitchen tasks. I'm Greg Willard. We'll be back in a moment. Stick around. Kitchens have been the setting for creative adventures for many centuries. Storytellers, poets, novelists, and songwriters have all used the warmth and comfort of the kitchen as their backdrop. Occasionally, an artist will also see something darker in the kitchen, as writer Esther Cameron reminds us in Witch's Kitchen.
No kitchen tour would be complete without a stop at the Witch's Kitchen, where in the first part of Goethe's Faust, Mephisto obtains a potion that transforms Faust from a weary, aging scholar to a dashing young seducer. The whereabouts of the original witch's kitchen is not known, but in your neighborhood there is probably a reasonable facsimile. The sign may say beauty parlor, but don't be fooled. Witch's Kitchen. Cornice and counter, loft and curving wall are clad in textured plastic like the hide of some tough copper-colored animal. An unclothed, puce, plush dummy sits astride one of the half-walls that divide the stations. displaying leggy legs, pointing her toes amid a flock of crimson bottled lotions. The mirrored space through facing mirrors grows, and human figures too reduplicate ad infinitum, till one scarcely knows flesh from figment. Here we sit in state, and priestesses in solemn headdress wield, while country singers softly ululate the spells that keep us pleasing to this world. I'm Esther Cameron from Mind's Eye Radio.
Kitchen maintenance is not likely to be a strong characteristic of a college-aged male. At least it wasn't for Jeff Black, who celebrated his freedom from the childhood chore of dishwashing by simply letting the dishes pile up in the dormitory sink. The aversion to doing the dishes hasn't yet passed, as we'll hear in Black's essay, My Dangerous Kitchen.
I grew up in the days when an automatic dishwasher was not a common household appliance. Therefore, my distaste for hand-washing dishes was instilled at a very young age. Washing the dishes was one of the many jobs my sister and I had to perform in order to earn our $3 to $5 a week allowance. And a battle always ensued over who would wash and who would dry. I preferred the drying part. For some reason, even though I loved spending hours on end submerged in the swimming pool, I had an adverse effect take place on my hands after prolonged exposure to water and dish soap. It's not that I was allergic, I just didn't like the prune effect when it came to work as opposed to play on my hands. My family eventually did get an automatic dishwasher, but it was too late because soon thereafter I moved away and again was subjected to hand-washing the dishes. I discovered college, whiskey, and women did not afford me the proper time to perform the task on a punctual basis. In radio college, I recall my buddy Jay and I going into the dorm kitchen with bandanas wrapped around our noses and mouths while attacking a three-week-old raunchy, hell-awful reeking pile of dishes. We repeatedly played the song The Dangerous Kitchen from Frank Zappa because it made the dirty deed seem not quite so bad.
The Dangerous Kitchen. If it ain't one thing, it's another. In the middle of the night when you get home, the bread things are all dry and scratchy. The meat things where the cats ate through the paper. The canned things with the sharp little edges that can cut your fingers when you're not looking. The soft little things on the floor that you step on, they can all be dangerous.
Both of us nearly vomited upon lifting a plate off the top of a bowl which had the now lab experiment type mold and stench of four different types of death hiding underneath. Who knew such good spaghetti could turn into something so evil? I've moved a lot in my life due to the radio business being such a transient career choice, and in a few of my apartments there were automatic dishwashers. Oddly though, I very rarely used them. And I've yet to figure out why. Perhaps it was my way of punishing myself for the seemingly innate laziness that I have displayed most of my life when it comes to scrubbies and suds. My problem with dishes is sort of like a hardcore recovering alcoholic fighting to not take that first drink. Once I leave just one or two dishes in the sink or nearby it moves from being the simple task of washing that which was just used, like a lone plate or fork or coffee cup, to this monstrous task where time and actual straining physical effort is necessary to correct the buildup. You'd think I'd learn. Sometimes I think I have. Every now and then, I think I'm cured. Once the kitchen is all cleaned, dishes done, all sparkling, I find myself wanting to keep it that way. So for a week, or maybe 5 days, I'll be meticulous. If I use a cheese grater, I wash the cheese grater. If I use a ladle, I wash the ladle. But then comes the crock pot, which needs to soak, of course, and it takes up the whole sink. The problem arises where, while it's soaking, for a day or two, there's no room in the sink to wash anything else, and before you know it, I'm right back where I started from, having a small, odd-shaped city of dirty dishes strewn across the countertop. This has been a problem for so long for me that I've actually thought, while hovering over a sinkful or trying to ignore them, that I just might start a support group for people like me. Hi, my name is Jeff, and I'm an anti-dishwasherholic. But I decided against that. I mean, who needs still one more excuse to leave the house and let that plate, milk glass, pizza pan, steak knife, strainer, soup bowl, cheese cutter, empty uncrushed beer cans, hordes of Tupperware containers, cutting board, measuring spoons and cups, sit in that sink, unattended, just one more day? I guess, if all else fails, I could simply stop eating altogether. I'm Jeff Black for Mind's Eye Radio, and yes, there is a pile of dishes on the countertop and in the sink right now. And I'm going to go wash them. Right after I do the bills.
Welcome to my kitchen. Pour yourself up a seat. You want to talk? I'll listen while I fix a special treat.
Special treat.
I know you've been unhappy. I know you're feeling sad. Some biscuits and gravy just might put an end to that.
Into that.
The aroma of my kitchen, the warmth you feel here. Melt your cares like butter
until they disappear.
So welcome to my kitchen. Make yourself at home. Welcome to my kitchen, where you'll never feel alone.
Feel alone.
Welcome to my kitchen. We can sit and relate. Forget those dirty dishes, have another piece of cake.
Piece of cake.
The aroma of my kitchen, the warmth you feel here, melt your cares like butter
until they disappear.
So welcome to my kitchen, make yourself at home. Welcome to my kitchen, where you'll never feel alone.
Or hungry.
I knew you were coming, and you heard needed fixing, so there's a pie in the oven.
In the oven.
The aroma of my kitchen, the warmth you feel here, melt your cares like butter
until they disappear.
So welcome to my kitchen, make yourself at home. Welcome to my kitchen, where you'll never feel alone. I got scones
and donut holes.
Want a cookie?
I've got those.
Plenty more. Help yourself.
This is Lynn Patrick Smith with Janet Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to In the Kitchen from the Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. Our show is produced by Kelly Warren with help from Dick Radke. Contributing writers include Jeff Black, Esther Cameron, Kathy Miner, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rawl, Lynn Patrick Smith, Evie Thompson, Paul Thompson, Geither Valtzen, and Sharon Van Sluice. Original music by Barbara Chusett. If you'd like a copy of this show, or you'd like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-276-9425 or catch our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. I'm your host, Greg Willard, leaving you with the words of American poet James Whitcomb Riley, who recalled his own childhood in the kitchen this way. And all us other children, when the supper things is done, we sit around the kitchen fire and has the mostest fun, a-listening to the witch tales that Annie tells about, and the goblins that gets you if you don't watch out. Until next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.